Once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite show on the net, your favorite anarchist show, anyway. So we have a new host, and she is Diane, and she's an IWW member. I myself was an IWW member for a few years. And so how are you doing, Diane?
Hi, I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. So, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Can you introduce yourself? What brings you here?
Sure. Well, I've been a member of the IWW for approximately 4 years now. Before that, I was involved with the New Jersey Independent Media Center. And in that work, I was doing a lot of freelance journalism, a lot of writing, a lot of website maintenance. And throughout this whole time, I've also been an anarchist, so I feel that my politics has shaped a lot of the work. Shaped a lot of the work I have done. And I am currently editing the IWW's newspaper called The Industrial Worker, and I'm hoping to gain more media exposure through that and through this radio show.
Pretty cool. Yeah, you know, in fact, for a few years, I wrote a few articles for the Spanish version. You know, they have a Spanish version of the IWW newspaper. Yeah, it's pretty cool. That's exciting. So what sort of drew you to the anarchist point of view? Was there anything in your life? Maybe we're getting too personal here, but you know, I think it's interesting.
Well, I could tell you that I became an anarchist on November 7th, 2000, which was the night of the presidential election in which George W. Bush stole the election. And prior to that, I was fairly active in campaigning for Ralph Nader and the Green Party. And when I was watching the results come in, and watching how the numbers were fluctuating a lot, I realized that the election itself was a big sham and that we couldn't put our faith in electoral politics. and basically became an I had already been introduced to the ideas of anarchism prior to that, but that was when I realized that I fundamentally agreed with them.
Very nice. And you work in which local or city do you work at?
IWW?
I mean, do you work with them in some particular place or?
I have for a number of years now. I've been a freelance journalist and a student. Not a student anymore. I was a student. So I was never involved with any shop floor organizing in the IWW. I've always done media support. But I've been very involved with the campaign to organize Starbucks baristas in New York City.
Yeah, that campaign actually has been an astounding success in many respects, right? Because it's been going on for a few years now, and they managed to organize a few shops, which was at the beginning it seemed almost impossible to try to tackle this giant, huh?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's still a very difficult feat because it's such a huge corporation and the IWW is so small. But even just putting on that kind of negative publicity onto the company, I think has had a great impact on their image and on what we are trying to accomplish in the IWW.
Right, you know, and that sort of made me think about something that Naomi Klein said. She talked about how one of the pretexts that they had in order to criticize unions is to say, well, these are not real jobs. These are just these are sort of joke jobs. You know, they're not a real job. It's just sort of a stepping stone, and so they can justify paying low wages, and because after all, it's not a real job, you see. But then it turns out that if you look at the economy, you have a huge percentage of jobs that are precisely that. So it's just it's a pretty bad joke, you know, that they would try to, but they do. In fact, that's a sort of a major justification for low wages and bad conditions. Well, it's a teenager's job. It's not a real job. It's a stepping stone. Have you heard that before? Or
Oh, plenty of times. And I think that's such a great excuse for people to not unionize and to not be become a part of organized labor. The state of most work in the U.S. is... Are these very precarious retail and food service positions. And meanwhile, we are not, the conditions aren't improving and people, I think people are sort of anticipating that they'll get better jobs and they don't really have to organize because this is just a thing they're doing in high school or they're doing to get through college or what have you. And so in that sense, it's even more important to organize so that they're not such precarious jobs, but that people can actually make a living off of them.
Right. And I mean, that's another thing that I noticed, that so people are so miserable in their jobs, or at least they're not very happy in their jobs. So they think, you know, why would I want to, get organized to gain some sort of, security at this job, because I don't, it's sort of like they don't really know or they don't really want to stay at that job, but it's not like you have that many great choices anyway, and it's sort of like you go around the block, you sort of like, maybe you work for this, for Starbucks, and you go work for, as a waitress for some restaurant, then you go somewhere else, but all these places are not unionized, so... You go hopping from place to place with the same sort of argument, but at the end of the day, the system stays the same. So it's it's pretty frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's definitely frustrating, and I think the U.S. has the worst not to sound too negative, but I think the U.S. has the worst sense of class consciousness of a lot of other Western countries I've seen. And because of that, people operate very individualistically and aren't always so inspired to take on collective action or to take on some kind of larger union campaign, because they're only thinking about the money they're making and the way that they're going to move out of the precarious workforce. And I think people over a few years realize that maybe it's not so possible to move out of this precarious workforce, because that is the state of the economy. Is the majority of people are going to be stuck in that trap for a while.
You know, and that sort of makes me think that, you know, one of the justifications that is always leveled against people who are a working class or don't have a lot of money is that, well, it's your fault that you know, you're not getting ahead in the system, you're not working hard enough, or you know, you're lazy, or you're not taking advantage of the opportunities you have. But on the other hand, if you're not poor, if you're actually well off, then they tell you the same thing, but with a different argument, sort of like with Michael Moore. They'll say, well, you've benefited from the system, so you know, you shouldn't be criticizing it. So either way, whether you have a lot of money or you don't have money, you can't criticize the system, because you know, they have all these little arguments but of course it's just nonsense. Because in any hierarchical system, obviously people are going to be at different levels, and they have to fight the system from wherever they're at, and that's part of it. So, yeah, it's a lot of propaganda out there. So, I guess reading the news here. Did you hear about Obama's Peace Prize, Nobel Peace Prize? What do you think about that? Do you think it was the war in Somalia, or the war in Afghanistan, or maybe the one in Iraq or Pakistan that he got it for? Or I can't, you know, I'm trying to guess here. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I think today marks the first day that we've officially entered some kind of Orwellian dystopia.
Right.
And this is the message I've been hearing all day from people all over. You know, they'll just these random posts on the internet that are basically under the premise of war is peace. And I think that it's pretty comical. I mean, one person said, you know, it's funny how on the same day that Obama decides to bomb the moon, he gets the Nobel Peace Prize, which I know it isn't entirely accurate, but to think of it that way is still pretty funny. I think it illustrates where our nation is right now.
Well, and you know, I was thinking about the economy, and it turns out the economy is so bad that ExxonMobil laid off 25 congressmen. Did you hear about that?
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't hear about that.
Right, you know, pretty crazy. So, anyway, I hear that you and Charnchi actually interviewed Chomsky, right? Was this today or
today?
Yesterday? Oh, wow. You just got back.
This was about 4 hours ago.
Is this the weekly thing that Charnchi has set up with Chomsky, where you guys, you know, where he goes every week and interviews him for 10 or 15 minutes? Is that it?
No, I believe Charnchi is doing that separately. This was a one-time deal for me, as far as I understand. My interview with him today was for the Industrial Worker,
nice.
which the IWW newspaper.
So what'd you guys talk about?
Sorry. So we talked about the economy. We talked about how the workers, mostly in the U.S., but also in Western nations, are responding to the depressed state of the economy at the moment, and also a little bit more about Chomsky talks a lot about democracy, so there he sort of incorporated that into the discussion today. But overall, I got the sense that he was feeling fairly optimistic about the future. That was the main question I had for him, was the future of the IWW and the future of the labor movement. And he basically said it will take a lot of work, a lot of shop floor organizing, but overall it can happen. It'll just be a big struggle to follow through with.
You know, I think maybe I'm a little biased because I've listened to Chomsky so much that you know, he actually, like, his routine is that every, and this is something I've noticed, is that every 6 months or so, he goes around the country and he sort of says the same things. And you sort of have to do that because you have to repeat the same things over and over again because the other side is doing the same thing. But sort of like, after a while, you're like, okay, I know that, but every once in a while, you'll get a sort of something like a nugget, you know, something new, and it's pretty exciting. But he, especially when you challenge him and you ask him probing questions and stuff. But as far as you know, the sort of questions that he gets, it's interesting that a lot of people feel the same things. They say, well, I'm I don't know what to do. I feel hopeless, blah, blah, blah. And then he always responds with the same answers, you know. Well, you know, we're privileged and, you know, there's so many things you can do. And it's true, you know, even look at what we're doing right now. You know, we're not risking anything here. We're not, we're doing this radio show or, you know, you're doing your industrial worker paper and, we're, you know, it's work, but we're not risking getting killed or anything. So, you know, it's true that we have we can do a lot of things with little risk. So, that's certainly true, and it's worth repeating. But did you guys upload any clips, or maybe you guys can play through the microphone? I know Charnchi didn't have time to upload any of the clips. But do you guys have anything ready there? Because maybe we could play something.
Yes, we do. We pulled together a few clips, each are between 1 and 4 minutes. And they're basically, they're just a little sound bites, from the interview. We, like you said, we didn't have time to get the entire interview, put onto the web or in sound bite form yet.
Okay.
But, yeah, we would love to play those.
Well, I guess while you guys set it up, maybe I can talk about okay, we don't need to talk about anything else. It's ready. All right. Okay, so, well, if you guys want to start with a clip, go ahead.
I would say a militant industrial action in workplaces, primarily throughout Europe, also North America, in North America, as you know, the Republic went to the Doors factory in Chicago. That was the first factory occupation, I believe, since the 1930s in the U.S.
No, not quite, because the Youngstown Steel was finished in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's something I mentioned that in the article. It's a model that really should be pursued now. But they went on to try to...
I think we're getting pretty bad audio there. Anyway, are you there, Diane?
Yes, I am here.
Yeah, that's I think that's not very good audio, so that's fine. Yeah, because the Blog Talk Radio audio is already pretty poor to begin with because of the bandwidth. So I think we really need to either upload it or so we can have it for the next show. That's fine. But maybe you can just talk about is there anything that he said that surprised you or you know, you, something you hadn't heard before or something?
To be honest, I mean, a lot of what he said seemed to have come from his recent essay, which was called Crisis, which was published in the Boston Review. It was the September/October issue. It's a great essay. It discusses a lot of different aspects of the economic crisis, both for the global north and for the global south. And it points to a lot of sort of what we can do in the future to improve our conditions. And while at the same time making a very, very substantive critique of why we're in this in this crisis in the first place. So we discussed a lot of aspects of that essay. But I would say one thing that he said that sort of inspired me, at least on a personal level, was his discussion about the regular sort of Joe Sixpack, or however you define it, worker who might be looking for answers. There are people who are, as he said, are getting shafted to. There are people who don't trust the liberal Democrats in New York or in Boston or in San Francisco because a lot of those people are the business owners, and they are pushing their own agendas for their own private interests. So people in middle America are turning to these immediate reactionary solutions that that right-wing pundits pose. And what Noam Chomsky said today was that basically we can find those people who are looking towards these right-wingers and say, we should for you too.
Yeah. I think it's a matter of providing another solution, because, yeah, he's right. I mean, there's a vacuum there, and these people are, you know, they're hurting, and they're given an answer, at least, you know, sort of like the right-wingers are saying, you know, it's this or it's that. It's the Federal Reserve, or it's these elitist liberals, or, I mean, whatever it is, but at least they're giving them an answer, and, you know, but our voice, the voice of... that should be heard, the voice of the radical left is not being heard at all, or it's not being heard very much. And I mean, that's part of what I wanted to address in my documentary Golden Rule, because at the beginning I talk about how, you know, their opposition to the government is not based on a truly anti-authoritarian you know, truly authoritarian way of seeing the world. It's based on a dogmatic idea that all evil authority is in some abstract entity called the government, which is somehow not connected to the corporate world. You know, it's something that's one of the reasons why a rational discussion is so needed. Because otherwise, people will drift toward these reactionary positions. And you know, Chomsky, I'm sure, mentioned that in Nazi Germany, you had a scapegoat or various scapegoats that sort of were meant to address some of these grievances, some of these legitimate grievances that people had, and that resulted in rather unpleasant government structure there. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can, it's about half hour, so we can take a little break. And let's play a Oaxaca song. All right.
Okay. I'm never asking for
So we're back, and are you there, Diane? Oh, wait a second. I need to turn on the mic here. All right, let's turn it on here. Diane, you there?
Okay. Yes.
So can yeah.
Can everyone hear me?
Yeah, okay. I can hear you. So wanted to ask you, Diane. Have you ever read the anarchist FAQ at infoshop.org?
Not the entire FAQ, but I've read portions of it. I believe the FAQ is over 1,000 pages.
Oh yeah, it's huge. But I always try to recommend it to people because I've always thought it's a great source of information for. I mean, it's not the ultimate word in anarchism. It's just that's why they call it an anarchist FAQ rather than the anarchist FAQ because but I think it does express a lot of consensus ideas about anarchism and what it means to a lot of people. So David and I were gonna do a video about condensing the first chapter and what anarchism is all about, and so I suppose that you started a lot of people started out more as a social democrat, socialist or something, and then you drifted over toward anarchism. Is that how it worked for you?
Not really, no, actually. Before I became an anarchist, I considered myself to be more of an environmentalist, I would say. I mean, as far as environmentalist could be on the northeast coast.
Uh-huh.
But I was not very political at all until I became an anarchist. Sort of knew there was something wrong with the world, and I knew there were problems, and I already was a vegetarian or a vegan prior to that. But it seemed that when I was doing this environmental activism, I grew to understand that there was a more systemic problem, which the vegetarianism or river cleanups or walks for the environment, or however, wouldn't solve the fundamental problems that existed.
So you're still a vegan?
And I think, I mean, I've been vegan for about 12 years now.
Well, I guess you and Charchi have something in common then, because I think he's been a vegetarian for a few years now. That's pretty. Maybe you guys can cook something together there.
Yeah, right. Every night we're eating tofu when we're
nice.
Whenever we eat together.
Yeah, you know, when I went to Boston in March, and because I went there to do the documentary, and we actually recorded also Howard Zinn and Chomsky and others, but you know, we had the Charchi there doing some sushi for us. He's a pretty good cook, man.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we form a collective one day, he'll have to be the official cook of the collective. Yeah, he's...
Definitely. The last time I came here, he was making soy ice cream from scratch.
Nice. And, you know, and I guess that... Yeah, well, I'm sure it was good. But, you know, I was thinking that Food Not Bombs would love to have someone like Charchi there. Although I don't know exactly how they work. I don't know if they actually cook stuff or if they simply ask for donated food. Do you know how Food Not Bombs works?
Mm-hmm. Oh, funny you should ask, because I was actually involved with Food Not Bombs for maybe 5 or 6 years. That was actually, I didn't really mention this before, but that was one of my first steps towards anarchism, was my involvement with Food Not Bombs. So I don't know if you want the fine details of how food is acquired and presented to the public, or I can just give you the nicer version of that. But basically, it's food is that would otherwise be wasted,
okay,
is either donated or acquired by Food Not Bombs volunteers. And the food is can sometimes come directly from, say, a grocery store or something, and it can be dry rice or dry pasta and vegetables. So the Food Not Bombs volunteers many times will have to cook. It can be a very difficult task to cook because the donations are very random. You can have, like, tons and tons of eggplant. Tons and tons of nothing else. So yeah. You have to kind of figure out with all that cabbage and eggplant and maybe a random thing like oats or something. So you have to try to work things out that way.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things that I was thinking about is that, you know, because certain items, you know, it's like a lot of people can recognize that they should not be part of a market system, or they shouldn't be, contingent upon money to be able to be consumed, like, you know, money, healthcare, and other things like that are basic for human survival. And sort of I think that the one of the good things about that project is that it allows people to realize that you know, that there is a possibility in having a world where people share things and sort of a more of a gift economy, a little bit like the real free market, or the real free market, or whatever it is. It's called the real market. Have you ever heard about that too?
The really really free market.
Yeah, that's right.
The really really free market.
Yeah,
it's a play on the free market.
Right.
But that's an event that's held once a year at St. Mark's Church in New York. And it's basically, it's a lot of anarchist groups and various other local community organizations and people come together and set up little stands and essentially barter. So, you know, say one group has DVDs and another group has vegan cupcakes, so they'll trade DVDs for vegan cupcakes, that type of thing. It's cool.
It's also here in San Francisco. I mean, and I think all over the country. I mean, they encourage people to start these out all over the country, when people just bring things and they give them out for free. But yeah, because I know that there's one here at a park here in San Francisco called Dolores Park, and they have one at the end of every month, and so apparently this kind of stuff is growing around the country, and I think it could, you know, sort of like it could have a demonstration effect. It can have a could have a positive effect. But have you ever been to one of these?
I personally have not been to one. I've donated items to a vendor, but I think my main criticism of it is a lot, I think a lot of people sort of depend on this idea of building a new society in the shell of the old. But we're not in the shell of the old society yet. We're still in the old society, and we have a lot of work to do to tear down the institutions that are exploiting us before we can start talking about before we can start really putting work into creating these barter systems or into living lifestyles of just sharing and just having events like that. I think we have a lot of more serious work to do, and I know a lot of people disagree with me because I think a lot of people just want to have fun and they just want to kind of have street parties every day, and that's cool. That's great for some people, but I think it ignores a lot of the root problems that we have to deal with
Right, like
before we can just have
organizing.
street parties all the time. Right, like organizing,
Right.
which
Well,
is tedious and not very fun all the time, but it has to be done.
right. I guess we can do a little bit of everything. Well, I guess to change subject a little bit, I was watching an interview with Robert Jensen. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a journalist, a journalist professor for University of Austin. And he wrote a book, and since you're a woman, I guess it would be interesting to ask you. He wrote a woman book about pornography, and he was talking about how, you know, that the pornographic industry sort of made a pretty good job at portraying themselves as if they were just sort of like as if their liberty, so-called liberty to sell pornographic video and all that stuff, was just sort of like something that would only be opposed by a close-minded people or Puritans or whatever, but he actually puts forth a critique of it that has to do with of course, you know, the capitalistic ethos that, you know, like obviously these women that have sex in camera and these men that have sex in camera, they do it for the money. I mean, you know, they're doing it for wages, so they're wageless like everyone else. But then there's other elements that are incorporated into it, such as the such as you know, like subjection, I mean objectification of women and of men sometimes. You know, I wanted to ask you to like, to what extent do you think that you know, sexual displays and are a valid form of expression, and to what extent do you think that they become illegitimate by virtue of their interaction with the market forces that we have in place and with some of the patriarchal sort of mentality that still pervades our society?
It's a very interesting question, and I have to say I've thought about it a lot in my life because there are certain elements of I want to say the radical movement who find that pornography is somewhat liberating and somewhat like not very objective. The only thing that's objectifying about pornography is the ownership, and if there's some kind of collectively run pornography website or however, then there's nothing objectifying of it about it. But at the same time, I personally believe, and again, people will and have disagreed with me about this, I personally believe that much of the pornography industry is based around patriarchy and is based around the objectification of women, because it generally, I would say 99% of the time, aside from when it's reacting to criticisms, is dependent on that objectification of women. So it's, I can't really say that's the case for everyone. I've definitely known many people who are sort of not sure what the word is, maybe pro porn or something, or pro sex, and they'll say that engaging in the production of porn is liberating, as long as it's some kind of collectively run project. But yeah, at the same time, it's a very complicated issue.
Yeah, I think that there's sort of a gray space there, because you know, people obviously have their own ways of expressing their sexuality and stuff, and I wouldn't want to interfere with that. On the other hand, I would say that my focus in trying to approach that issue would be that to take away the incentives, such as, you know, the pressure of wage labor, you know, and some of the other things in our society that sort of draw people toward that activity, and many other activities that people don't want to perform, and that they do just because our system imposes a sort of a coercive set of choices. You know, you have to rent yourself to the people who control the capital and the means of production, and you know, and that's why you do it. You don't see, like, you don't do things because you really want to do them in an ultimate sense. You know, you don't really want to work at Starbucks. You don't really want to make that pornographic film. And the question is, would that person still make the pornographic film if they had a lot of money? If they didn't need the money, if they were doing it out of simply fun, or, you know, if that was the reason, I think there would be fewer reasons for anyone to object to it. But as it stands now, I think that the intermingling with the capitalist system is really what stands out as very illegitimate. So, but yeah,
well, yeah, I think just one point to add about that. I think that, like I said, the pornography is essentially based on an objectification of women. And to me, this is, again, something people, even feminists, a lot of feminists will disagree with me on. But to me, I think that even without the money involved, there's still a sort of a fundamental sense of pornography, of men dominating women. And I think that even without money, that still drives a lot of the motivation for people doing it. But that's again my two cents. So
I guess we would have to, like, analyze a lot of aspects of it that are difficult to analyze. I mean, I actually haven't read Robert Jensen's book. Apparently, it's pretty good, but I haven't had a chance to read it. But for anyone who's interested out there, I think that the book is called Getting Off, and it was written a few years ago. So, I think that's an interesting subject. But, I guess we could talk a little bit about the industrial worker and How many years has it been running now? I guess from its very inception, right? From the very inception of the IWW, the Industrial Worker has been the official newspaper of the IWW.
It has been the newspaper since 1906. So the IWW came into existence in 1905, and it took about a year for them to get their own newspaper. And it has been, it's gone through some rough phases, I believe, and I have to double check this actually, but I believe there was a time period where it wasn't being published on a regular basis. More recently, it has grown in its circulation and its popularity. So it's a very interesting job that I have, because it's, you know, I'm basically editing a newspaper every month, which is a mouthpiece of a union not very popular amongst a big part of the labor movement. But it's also not very popular amongst a lot of people in the activist movement. So, but at the same time, like, I feel that the IWW is on the fringes of both the labor movement and the activist movement. And the people who are in the union are very much a part of both movements. So what I'm trying to do is sort of incorporate our ideas and our actions into both.
So we have David on the line. So let me bring him in here. Mm-hmm. Hey, David, how you doing, man? Are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm very good. Yes. So I have this. I have an issue with women being placed in the workplace, man. Because I don't think that women think the same way as chaps do. Do you think that?
Is this David?
I think they think very... Yes, man. But I think they think very differently to the way we do. I think they're a little bit soft, you know, in the head. In the way that they think. You know, they're weaker than us. And we work hard, and they don't. They talk around coffee pots, man, and they are very strange people, man. Because if you say to a woman, Jesus, you have a really nice ass, they get really upset. I don't get why they get upset. If you're saying to a person, you know, you have a very nice backside, why do they, why are they getting upset when we, all we're saying is that we like it?
Well, I don't think that was David, actually. I think that was some guy.
Think that was David.
No, that
wasn't
David.
Was that L.A.G.?
No, we always have callers or people who maybe play some record or play something to us. So this happens pretty much during every show. Yesterday we had some guy calling in about something else. So. No worries. Okay, so I think David here is on the other line. Let me see here. Hey, Dave.
Man.
Are you there?
So basically when someone comes on the channel and they're named SkypeAssholes.com, this should probably raise a red flag. Although that was a very eloquent monologue the person gave.
Right.
On the inadequacy of women in the workplace. But yes, how are you all doing?
We're fine. How are you doing, man?
We're good.
I'm great, except for, may I share a little piece of local news from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada? The CBC is reporting that a temporary measure was passed in Parliament just during a big miscellaneous bill. I read the thing. I couldn't even find it. That allows people who possess anti-Olympic signs can go to jail for up to 6 months and be fined $10,000 in Vancouver during this period that the 2010 Olympics are happening in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. It's worrying a lot of people, and it's being talked about by the CBC. It's not no conspiracy. conspiracy theory. It apparently appears to be legitimate that this was kind of railroaded through in a miscellaneous municipality bill, and it's kind of scaring a lot of people here because we wanted to protest, and it in fact gives the police the authority to, one day before any protest that they're notified of, they can go in and seize Olympic signs or anti-Olympic signs.
Wow.
I just thought, well, you would think about that. It's pretty scary for me and my friends.
Right, and you know the Olympics bring nothing but trouble. I mean, I remember still the Beijing Olympics, and they were moving people around, like a million people had to be transferred somewhere else, and all kinds of tyrannical laws and gentrification. It's a nightmare, and of course they're trying, and of course they exalt the supposed unity of nations, but it really, but of course you know it's about competition, and it's about all these values that we stand against, you know, it's pretty, that's pretty scary. Did this happen in your lifetime before?
Yesterday.
No, I'm saying, have you been aware of other games, other Olympic games where this was actually implemented?
This is a temporary, so it's not a law that applies today. What it'll apply is during the 10 or so days during the Olympics, the police will have very enhanced authority. I don't know, like, yes, it happened in Canada before. We declared martial law in the 70s when there were Quebec separatists. That's what I know of in Canada. Around the world, I'm sure it's happened all the time. And in Canada, it's definitely happened before. But this is particularly scary because it's just protecting a corporate event from people expressing themselves, as opposed to terrorists, you know, bombing the streets or kidnapping senators, which is what happened in the 70s. So it's a pretty extreme overreaching of power, I feel.
Right.
Just protesting.
And let's not forget that the sponsors of the Olympics are big corporations, as they're the sponsors of everything else. But yeah,
it goes without saying, yeah.
Right. And so the Olympics are happening in Vancouver.
In 2010, yeah.
Oh, okay. And they're happening in a few years, or when are they happening?
In a few months.
Oh, wow.
February. Yeah, this is why it's scary, because the fact that this is passed so closely to the Olympics actually occurring, it's very, very big sneak attack, you know. All my friends who are anti-Olympics are worried. I mean, Vice, through the Vancouver Integrated Security Unit, has been visiting friends of people who are anti-Olympic protesters' houses to obtain as much information from them as is possible. Like, this is the what's happening for this supposed wonderful event. You know, bonding nations together in sport. It turns out it's just railroading the individuals who simply do not support the event. I mean, it's not controversial to not support an event, as far as I'm concerned. I don't understand where all the fear of individual protest comes from within our parliament. This blindsided me that I saw this today. I'm shocked.
Well, hopefully you guys will find ways to protest the event in a way that you can evade some of this repression. I know that's
hopefully
not always easy, but but you know, yesterday I was talking about the G20 report, and I think that's worth reading to get some ideas. I think a lot of these protests are trying out new tactics and strategies that may be applied for future events.
Oh, absolutely! We should be smart about it. But this is pretty close to strangulation of the. If we can't even have a sign in a crowd. Even if that was restricted, it would be bad enough. But the fact that the police can I can't even believe it. It seems remarkable that such lengths have been gone to just prevent someone from bringing a sign to an event.
Yeah.
Not good.
Thanks for calling, man.
Depressing you. Sorry.
Well, I think we talked mostly about depressing stuff anyway, so it's okay.
There's hope, like you said.
Yeah. All right, man.
All right. Bye. All right.
Well, that was David from Vancouver. Pretty messed up, huh? I don't think that we want to have the Olympics over here either. I'm glad we didn't. The U.S. didn't win the. And you know, it's funny because all the liberals were really sad. Oh, we didn't win the Olympics, and they were playing the little left right game where they were accusing the right wingers. They were saying, you know, it's Bush who passed all these Patriot Act laws, and now the reason why they didn't give us the Olympics is because it's so difficult for people to get visas and come over to the United States. So I mean, it was of course missing the whole point that these Olympics are not good for the citizens or for the city. So anyway, well, I guess we're getting close to the end. Is there anything else on your mind?
Nothing I can think of. It's been a long day today, and we're hoping to upload the entire interview, both the audio form and the video form, in the coming days. So everyone should look for that. I believe it will be under. Where will it be under?
It'll be on the website.
On the main website.
Great, and maybe we can play some clips. Some clips for the next show, because it sounds like a very interesting interview with Chomsky. Well, I guess we're by 1 minute before the end of the show, so I'm gonna leave off with a song. And thanks for joining, and Diane, and I guess we'll see you next week.
Great. Thank you having me on.
I guess we could talk about a little bit about Zach and Vanzetti.
Wait a second. Maybe. No, that's not the song. Okay, let's play a song before that. Getting confused here. Where's the song?
90 seconds.
All right. We're going to play Scarlet Tide, song by Elvis Costello. There we are.
Well, I recall his parting words. Must I accept his fate or take myself far from this place? I thought I heard a little bird did sing. Man has no choice when he wants everything. We'll rise above the scarlet tide that trickles down through the mountain and separates the widow from the bride. Man goes beyond his own decision, gets caught up in the mechanism of swindlers who act like kings and brokers who break everything. The darker night was swiftly fading close to the dawn of day. Why would I want him just to lose him again? We'll rise above the scarlet tide that trickles down through the mountain and separates the widow from the bride.